You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Parrott. Our broadcast license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, but swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces and walks of life than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop the occasional profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it seems to be becoming more commonplace in other environments as social and cultural norms have changed. We're talking about swearing now with one of the world's leading experts on our so-called naughty and taboo words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have your views or practices on swearing changed over time? Do you swear now more than you used to? Do you notice other people swearing more? Where and when? What contexts and places are appropriate, or is there no right time or place? Call in, keep it clean, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. His book titles include Why We Curse and We Did What? Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, I'm darn glad to be here.
Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear. And children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you're like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that, every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally the categories of words that that become taboo. And the English speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The 4-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation, and they're policed by what I call the institutions of power, like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234 on swearing and cursing, keeping it clean, of course. And speaking of keeping it clean, we've got, you used the darn earlier, the shoot, the fudge.
Yes.
They feel a little silly sometimes. They don't seem to express exactly the same emotions. Why is that?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that they do. These are euphemisms. So they're sort of cover words. They're used a lot by Mormons. I've worked with a study on how Mormons use these instead of the more potent four-letter words. So they kind of stand in. I think people probably they relate to or connect with the underlying obscenities with these words when they're substituted. But they allow us or the speakers who use them to vent or express emotions in a more polite way. I think that's the value of using these. That's why I said darn in the beginning. I could have said damn. That's acceptable. Yep. in media. But it wasn't 100 years ago. With the power of the church 100 years ago, you couldn't say things like that on the radio or in the early film industry. So with the decline of the power of the church in America, these what are technically profanities that are religious references have lost their power. And so we find them, like the euphemisms, are used frequently now, not 100 years ago, but the OMG, we hear that. And I hear a lot of people say, oh my God. I hear more women say that than men. I hear more children say that. I don't know. I play golf and hockey. I don't hear my teammates saying, oh my God. They usually use saltier four-letter words. But I think that's the value of these euphemisms in their time and place. They're more appropriate.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a five-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, occasionally say, the four-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents, and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. Don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. Like, why are you using this word? Are you angry? You can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years is the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. If you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it. But if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in the in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the four-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I got to ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not
no,
one
I
of
was,
the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with her a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some of those languages, And this made her feel more comfortable bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob,
have at it.
That is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. Certainly, if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer, and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes, and what he reported is happening. What is happening is there in a nursing home, you have sort of, with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood, the people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits, and they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings. And where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia, I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common, along with a lot other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, that the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures. Somehow, for one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we happen? We use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden. And there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word. Those words have been around for 1,000. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that obviously today is the expansion of hip hop culture around the world, globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip hop from music and other genres of hip hop. And they, you know, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet. But again, if you get a new word, a new plant, an exotic in your garden, and it doesn't resonate with the speakers of that culture, then it will disappear. And that's very common for slang, for slang terms. I can think of the slang of the 60s when I was growing up. Nobody would use that kind of language now. But we're now having cross-cultural conferences on offensive language, which would have never happened 50 years ago.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy J., psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well, but my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on, are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles, and where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where what happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. But expect them to learn this. And also, problematic is, you know, talking about sexuality with your parents is also difficult. So, I think I would anticipate this. I've worked in dozens of different contexts. I worked in a factory. I worked with my father, who was a bricklayer, and the language shifted in all these places. When I, as a professor for 40 years, I rarely used this language in the classroom unless I was angry. And I think that's, I think, again, like raising your children is helping them learn to express their emotions. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you, or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where you, where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here, or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners to support public radio. I do.
Thank you so much. That's Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of a number of books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's with us today to talk about why people curse and swear and how the cultural norms around those taboo words can change over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on a challenge to the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan. We'll check out the legal challenge and what's at stake. Plus, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold joins the show for a look at judges and the string of judicial appointments since President Biden came into office. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, more companies are experimenting with a four-day work week. A Wisconsin business professor joins the show for a look at the advantages and the drawbacks of the change. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, non-dairy milk alternatives can still be labeled as milk, according to newly released FDA guidelines, as long as those products provide some additional nutrition information. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show with a plan to take the M word off of soy, almond, rice, and other beverages. First, one of those great feelings at work is when you leave the office on a Thursday, knowing you've got Friday off for some reason, your three-day weekend is about to begin, while your coworkers are stuck coming back in for one more day. What if you could feel that way each and every week without using vacation time or reducing your salary? Some companies are starting to experiment with making the four-day work week their permanent structure. A pilot study recently wrapped up in the United Kingdom where employees worked 80% of their normal hours for 100% of their normal pay while committing to maintain 100% of their productivity. The results showed improvements in employee well-being and also increased revenues for the companies involved. But not every workplace or industry is set up to function on that kind of four-day work week. The shift can create additional challenges in some kinds of work. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the prospect of a four-day work week? Would you like to see it implemented where you work? Would something like that be successful in your workplace? Why or why not? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Alexander Stykovich is an associate professor of management and human resources in the UW-Madison School of Business. His research focuses on leadership and organizational behavior. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Thanks for the invitation to be on the show.
I keep seeing things come up about the four-day work week, including this UK study I just mentioned. Why do you think we're seeing maybe more interest from companies thinking about a four-day work week lately?
Well, I think initially it's because the question is both intellectually stimulating and broadly consequential. So it's stimulating because it juxtaposes business and social goals, And that's always interesting because they're on different metrics. And the consequences of this could be broad, both to what you do at work and what you do at home.
Now, if I own a business, there are lots of kinds of businesses, but I might worry, okay, my employees are only coming in 4 days a week and they're not working longer days, well, they're there 80% of the time. Are they going to get 80% as much done? When you look at the studies that are out there, what do we look at when we figure out if we're going to lose productivity by working fewer hours?
And I think that's the key question, really, because if we start with a hypothesis of this question or the English study, it's we're going to go down to 32 hours from 40 hours. We will maintain the pay, and the performance will either be the same or better. So we're saying less is more, which is possible, mm-hmm. but it's rare. And it really requires some serious substantiation in terms of theoretically why should this happen and what kind of evidence we have. This English study, if I may, I may sound a little bit like a pros and cons on it.
Which is fine.
And that's just because I think I'd like to provide a balanced conversation so we don't set up our managers to fail, basically.
Sure.
So it's very intriguing, it's very interesting. So with the English study at first, I wouldn't bet on it.
Okay.
Put it that way. And skeptic might ask, why is that? So let me give you a few kind of reasons why, and you can jump in at any time.
Sure.
So the study was about the benefits of 4-day week, but it was done by an advocacy group called 4-Day Week. So a skeptic might ask, what are the odds they'll find something against a 4-day week, right? And of course, they found support. A study was not peer-reviewed. As far as I know, I looked everywhere to see if data would be public, if people wanted to reanalyze, and as far as I can tell, it was not. So let me give you maybe two or three key issues, right? So the first one is, they're saying that their independent variable was something that was meaningful. Meaningful reduction in work. So it wasn't defined like percentage or number. It was meaningful. Okay, we're fine with that. But then they allowed that to vary by different companies. So basically, they had different independent variables. As they say, they had it staggered, decentralized, annualized, and conditional. Well, that would be like you provide a patient with 20 milligrams, 30, 40, and 50, and then it's like, well, which one worked? Well, so that's one big problem, right? We don't know exactly what was the independent variable. So that's one. On the dependent variable, that was probably the biggest problem. They went from the average work week of 4.86 days. So it wasn't five to start with. But then what they examined was 4.52 days, Rob.
Oh, okay. So they didn't cut from five to four.
So
completely.
It wasn't cut to 20%. So the cut was 7%. So it's a little easier to find same performance if the difference is 7% versus 20%. So those are the two kind of biggest issues with that study.
Well, now you look at employee motivation, among other things, what motivates people to work. Is there in your research something to suggest that, okay, if we cut some hours from workers in certain circumstances, they're going to be healthier and happier, or in some other way they're going to benefit from it in a way that makes them more productive workers in the time that they're there?
It could be, and you're right. That's what I study, basically, what makes people motivated at work, right? And how do we do that? So I can make an argument in two or three senses as to how that could happen, but I think that should be balanced by about five or six that would go in the other direction, right? So the big question is, why should this work, right? What is the variable? What is the motivation variable that would make you work less, produce the same or more? What that assumes is that your goal is going to go up, right? Because you're squeezing 40 hours into 32. Mm-hmm. So whatever your goal is, it goes up, and your goal goes 20% up. Now, that's a little tricky premise here, because that either means, I hate to say it, your people are slacking now, if you have a 20% buffer. or you need to come up with really some great procedures that we haven't thought of. So, and by the way, nobody in Gold Theory recommends 20% increase, at least not overnight, maybe gradually over time. So that's the first problem with the goal difficulty. Second one is, if you have a higher goal, maybe you need new skills to achieve the higher goal, right? Third one is, what will that do to your cognitive overload? Now, that could be the positive variable. It could be that simply by working a day less, their cognitive overload goes down, they have more mental processing available, and they do better.
Right. So I wonder about the kind of work. If it's you're producing X number of units per hour on a assembly line or a grocery clerk or something like that, that 20% increase probably isn't going to happen. But people might say, okay, what about a creative problem-solving work, and the having more time off, more free time is going to make you more creative. You're going to use the time you have more efficiently because you have that more free time.
And that's a great point, right? So there are some industries in which this is just not feasible, right? Use your local post office person, right? He has the same amount of mail. Now what is he going to do? Start speeding or hurting neighbors and stuff? So that's not possible. Now, creativity could be one of the industries where this should work, except that more efficiency is negatively correlated with creativity. So if I force you to be more efficient and say, listen, Rob, you have 32 hours. You better produce the same as you produce with 40 hours. So watch every second, watch this, watch that. I'm putting more pressure. The more pressure I put on you, the less working memory you have to be creative. So in a way, my bet is it would stifle creativity. Now, if you let him have it, and all, that's a different story. But if you just have the same equation, let's squeeze it into 32, I'm not sure.
We're talking to UW-Madison business professor Alex Stajkovich about the four-day work week, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? What are the biggest pros and cons that you see? Have you done this? Have you had a job where you work for 8-hour days and that counted as full-time, or for 10-hour days? I did that at a job for a year or so. It was nice to have the extra day off. Those 10-hour days were kind of long. Think about your own workplace. Do you see a way in which a four-day work week would work for you, for your coworkers? If you had more people, would it take that to make it work? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Alex Stajkovich, professor in the UW-Madison School of Business, with us today looking at the potential benefits and drawbacks of a four-day work week. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences maybe. If you've worked in a place that was full-time at, say, 4 days a week, did it work? Did it not work? Is this an idea that you think would be effective in your place of work, whatever that might be? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Tim is with us in Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I was trying to figure out the flip side of this coin, meaning the detriments or the benefits to the employee. Main questions being, if we go from 40 hours a week to 32, does a salary, does an hourly wage get increased with that? For salaried employees, as they work on a basis of finishing job objectives, and that's what their pay is based on, they may work 50 to 55 hours a week. If a regular work week is reduced from 40 to 32, how does that affect a salary employee? And the last question I have is about benefits. If you've got a 401, if you've got an employer that pays workman's comp, how does that all switch when hours worked per week are reduced? Gotcha. If you have people that have educations that don't want to lose their wage because hours are reduced, they want to benefit of reduced hours, but they don't want to reduce a wage.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Great practical questions there. The study, despite its flaws, the idea was holding salary steady while cutting back on hours. I imagine it could be very demotivational if I went to employees and said, good news, you're working 4 days a week. Bad news, you're taking a 20% pay cut. What do you think, Alex?
Well, yeah, or a skeptic might reframe the same thing and say, well, if you know, there's part-time available, if you want to do 32 hours, you're welcome to do it. And especially if you're willing to get less for that.
Thanks for the call, Tim. One suggestion I've seen, and again, and just some of the people commenting on this UK study, is the idea of okay, maybe we won't get this enhanced productivity. We'll even things out by hiring more people at fewer hours. We'll have a bigger staff, maybe a little more slack for when people get sick or whatever. We're employing more people, and maybe we can hold steady on productivity and not increase costs too much. What do you think about that, Alex?
Well, I think that's a different premise, because that's more of a labor economic spread out, hire more people. That's a different idea from, let me tell you, less is more. And here is this X motivational factor that would make that happen. I was dying to find in this literature, what is that factor that would actually do that? So to me, that's kind of in a way more interesting, that, because again, we can hire an economist, they'll figure out the other things, but I haven't seen what that was. That is my biggest problem with this.
Thanks a lot for that call. Gail joins us now in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Back in my day working for big corporations back, they started what they called summer hours, which were special hours where you worked a couple of extra hours. It was still a 40-hour work week, but you got your Friday afternoons off. When it turned out, most everybody ended up working that Friday afternoon too. So the strategy of the corporation actually worked, because they were doing it during the summer, which was to try to get more work out of people during the summertime, than because vacations and people are wanting to be out and taking some time. This caused the corporations to get free work out of people, basically, because a lot of people were on salary. So how many hours they work, how many hours they work.
Gail, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Alex, you were nodding along with that. Oh, why is that?
Well, there was another confound in that related to that question, potentially, which is it's called history effect. I can maybe get these findings depending on how I design the study. Mm-hmm. So if I start in December and end in June, generally speaking, seasonally, depression reduces, or is the highest in wintering, gets lower and lower in the summer months. And that was certainly not controlled in the English study.
Gail, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the four-day work week, one specific study, and more general concepts about it. You could join in with your thoughts, your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Heard from Patrick in Oconomowoc, who said he works a 4x10 shift, so 4 10-hour days a week. Loves having 3-day weekends, can go up north. It's great for someone in midlife age. I used to have a 4x10, but I was off on Wednesday, which is a great day to get errands done. What do you think, Alex? I don't know if there's research out there, but that kind of flexibility for workers where they can, you know, if they want, get their 40 hours in 4 days. Do you think people respond to that kind of flexibility?
I think they might, if it's feasible for the business.
Right.
Right. So assuming we're not talking some input-output manufacturing, mm-hmm. that it has to be done, I'm all for it. And I had some great stories from students over years on flex schedule. And it's not because flex schedule is all that intellectually interesting, but it's because the needs, preferences, fears, anxieties you have might change. And sometimes that change in schedule can really hit the spot and make you motivated for whatever other reasons you might have, right? Mm-hmm. So let me give you one example from many years, if I may, really
sure.
quickly.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. The guy was saying, listen, I would have never thought of flex schedule. That's not it, except I had this person who was working. It wasn't working out. Basically, here's what it was. So I asked him. I said, hey, what can we do about this? And he said, listen, I have two teenagers at home. My wife just passed. And here's my problem. Currently, the way my schedule works, when they come from home, I'm not home yet. When I come home, they're gone to post-school activities. When they come back, I'm tired. They're tired. We don't get to see each other at all. We don't have supper together. If there is any way to either move it this way or that way so that we overlap at least once a day, preferably around 3:30 when they come home, that would be everything for me. This manager says you would not believe the change, because at that particular time, it was that flex schedule that really worked for that person. So I give credence to it, but it really depends whether it's needed or not.
Sure, and that seems like that kind of thing is really hard to scale.
Absolutely.
Meeting your individual needs versus what do I do in my 300-person company?
And that's always the question. That is always the question, how we scale it. And I don't give too much slack to managers in that. That's why you paid more. Go figure it out. Do behavioral audit. And you don't really manage 300 people. You manage 5, 10. They're immediately under you. So try to figure out their needs, and they'll figure out somebody else. So it's not easy, obviously. But I think at least there is something that could be done to improve that.
Talking to Alex Stajkovich, professor in the UW-Madison School of Business, looking at various ways to tackle the idea of a four-day work week. Back to your calls now with George in Ashland. George, hello.
Gentlemen, I wanted to let you know I have a son who is a salaried professional engineer working for a municipality. And in their situation, they get an extra day off every other week by working a 9-hour day, 5 days a week the first week, and 4 days a week the second week. So that's covers still a 40-hour average work week, but the extra day off every other week for this family with two children and two working parents just seems to work out beautifully for them.
And George, do you know, is this something that that municipality offered, or did your son kind of go to them and say, can we tweak this so I can have this day off? How did that come about?
I think originally it was individuals asking for the tweak, and I think now it's generally available, but I'm not positive about that.
So there's some of that negotiated flexibility again, Alex.
Yeah, and especially if you need it. I think it's perfectly okay to approach your manager, going back to being idiosyncratic, and say, hey, right now in my life, here is the situation, and that one extra day would really work out for all kinds of different reasons. I think a lot of managers are reasonable, and they consider it, again, if it's possible, given the system and the structure. So I'm perfectly okay if people do that. I would encourage them. I would hope they would come to me with questions like that.
George, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Okay, Alex, say a business owner reads these UK studies. Here's what you're saying. Okay, they're not perfect studies, but I'm interested in trying it. What would you recommend they think about, talk about, plan before they dive into a four-day work week at their site?
So first I'd say, listen, for every complex problem, there is a simple solution and it's wrong. Meaning, please think about it before you do it. What are the variables in it? Why should this work and why should this not work? And unless that's explained somehow to you in some satisfactory manner, I'm not sure I would do it. I would certainly meet with my employees then, try to discuss, try to tell them what I'm doing so they don't think it's some psycho mumbo jumbo and then we change it. Well, think about it. If it doesn't work, I have to go back then and say, listen, somebody failed, right? Either me or you or all of us. So I would be certain to do it up front to explain what's going on, get input from them. Why do you think this might work for us? Mm-hmm. And it might be maybe a lot of young people with kids, so that might be the reason. On the other hand, it might not work because they might say, that's not my issue now, but I need a little more income. I actually would prefer, if I could, if you're going to pay me same for 32, to work the other 8 plus to make more. So I would try to get data on the ground with our own people. Where do we stand? Why should this work? If they start it, I would make sure to measure things. So if you say the subjective well-being is going to increase, measure it. And then relate it to outcomes and kind of see where we stand with that.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invite. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking to Alexander Stajkovich, Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources in the UW-Madison School of Business. His research focuses on leadership and organizational behavior. He joined us for a look at companies that are moving to four-day work weeks, or at least giving it a try. You can keep sharing your thoughts, maybe your experiences, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, what is milk? Is it only the stuff that comes from a cow or other mammal? Or do soy, oat, rice, almond, coconut, the list goes on, beverages count? Well, the FDA, they came out with new guidelines saying you can keep calling it milk with a little extra info. We'll hear from Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about new legislation she has on the issue. And you could share your thoughts. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.